All attendees are in listen-only mode.
Welcome to today's GDB webinar. My name is Rachel Dager. I'm the Associate Executive Director of SNEB and glad to have you with us for the presentation today. Just a little bit of housekeeping to get us started. If you look in the handout block of your GoToWebinar tool panel, you'll see that the handout for today's presentation is available to download. And that would be a good thing to have as you follow along and need to make any notes for the presentation. We will take questions at the end of the webinar, so please type those in the question box, and we will moderate those who are presenters. If you do have a question during the presentation, go ahead and type that in, because if it's relevant to the part of the material that we're covering, our speakers have agreed to take a break and clarify that for you. When I close out the session, there'll be a short survey, and we appreciate your feedback on this session, as well as any comments as far as future Journal Club topics. We're definitely looking at what we're going to plan to do for the spring, and would entertain ideas for the topic for the spring. And then, as a reminder, watch for an email. I'm actually going to try to get the email out today with a link to the recording, the CEU certificate that you're earning for your attendance today, as well as the slides again. So our moderator today is Virginia Quick. She's in the Department of Nutritional Sciences at Rutgers University.
Thank you, Rachel, for that nice introduction. So we are very excited today to have speakers with us. One being Dr. Paul Rosen. He is PhD in biology and health at Harvard under the direction of the mayor. He has been at the University of Virginia for 52 years and currently professor of psychology there. As an editor of the journal Appetite for and for about the last 40 years, has made in human food choice from philosophical, psychological, and cultural. We also have with us today Naomi Arbit. She is a PhD candidate in the behavioral nutrition at Teachers College, Columbia University, and her PhD advisor is Dr. Paul Rosen, who is at the University of Pennsylvania. And together with Paul, Naomi is studying the moral psychology of food choice and the meaning of food in life prior to studying at Columbia. Naomi earned her MA in bioethics from NYU. And so we're excited to have them speak with us today about the culture and the meaning of food. So I will let Dr. Bergen take the lead.
Okay. Hello, everybody. Can you hear me? Is this going through okay?
Yes. Yeah.
It is. Okay, good. So welcome to this webinar. It's going to be a little different from your usual subject. I don't think we're going to mention saturated fats or sugar or antioxidants in this entire talk. It's more the we're assuming, of course, you all have extensive knowledge of nutrition, and we're not going to discuss that, but sort of a larger framework that you might put it into. So let's start with the change that the world has gone through in the late 20th century. A number of things have happened that have changed the way we eat. One is that there was the epidemiological revolution. Most people now do not die of immediate effects of food, infectious or toxic effects, but rather from degenerative diseases which are related to diet, but that they don't have a clear effect when you eat something that might be poor for your longevity. You don't experience anything when you eat it. So the link between diet and health is much weaker from the point of view of the perception of the person eating. Secondly, we in the developed world, which is about 20-25% of the world, we have a food surplus. Though there are individuals who are short of food, most people are surrounded by food and all sorts of food, and they're not really, neither financially nor in terms of availability, we're very much restricted by what they eat. Third, we have an extraordinary range of food choices. You can get, you know, wherever you are pretty much in the United States, you go to a supermarket, you can get bok choy, you can get Mexican food. You can get almost anything. And we know in general that the more variety you give people, the more they eat. So we're giving them a lot of variety. Now we've also developed superfoods, foods that play upon our biological tendency, for example, to like sugar and fat. And, of course, the prototypical superfood, which is a favorite food of many people, including myself, is chocolate, which is a processed food. It's nothing like a chocolate bean, and it is a sort of a calorie bomb, which has lots of fat, tastes very sweet, and has a wonderful aroma. I mean, it's hard to say no to chocolate. Our ancestors did not face that possibility. Now we also have arranged it so we don't need to work to get any food choices. We used to have to go out and get them. And even as long ago as 100 years ago, we had to go to the store. Now you don't have to do anything. You can either go once a week to the supermarket in the mall and fill up your station wagon, or you can just sit on your computer and click something and something will appear. So we've broken the link between energy expenditure and energy attainment. And finally, we have, let me just get this to happen naturally. No, my screen isn't working. Just a moment, folks. There it goes. We have, our education system has lagged behind our technology so that we have all these foods, we have labels on them and all this stuff, but we don't train people in dealing with risks and benefits in high school or in elementary school. We don't train them in nutrition at all. So they come into this world with thousands of foods, with complicated labels, and all this information they're hearing, this is good for you, this is bad for you, and we just haven't caught up. It's very generally true that education lags behind technology. It's not just in food. Okay, so just let me, we're going to be talking about the developed world mostly today, but I just want to remind you that that's less than 30% of humanity, depends how you count, but the great majority of humans are in a developing world where a lot of the things I just told you are not true. There isn't necessarily a food surplus. There is a serious food toxicity and infection problem and so on. Just to give you a sense, this is the latest data I could get. It's the 1980s, so it's a while ago. This is the percent of people's expenses that are devoted to different categories. And you see in that time, it's somewhat lower now. In China, India, and Indonesia, three of the biggest countries in the world, they were spending more than half their money on food. In Russia, a little less. France, a lot less. We, less than France. I've heard we're below 10% now of our total income that is spent on food. But for most of these people in the developed world, food is their major expenditure. So it's central in their life on a daily basis. And just to remind you, there are now 870 million, according to one estimate in the UN, chronically malnourished people in the world, almost all in the developing world. And we are not going to talk about them today, but they are the biggest problem. I mean, there are more malnourished people than there are obese people in the world. And though we should be concerned about obesity, we should even be more concerned about malnourishment, which is easier to treat than obesity. Food is the solution to malnourishment. Complicated therapy or surgery, which doesn't usually work, is the solution for obesity. Now, one of the themes that I want to present to you is that as we go through life, every culture has its own specialties, things that it does well, things that it doesn't do well. And one of the things which we should be trying to do is look around the world, not just about food, and see who does this well, who does mail, who does railroads well, and see if we can export that to our culture and learn something. So here's my example of heaven, where the Italians do love, the Swiss do the banks, the British do the universities, and the French do food. And here is hell, where the Swiss do love, the Italians run the banks, the French run the universities, as soon as I can get that to move down. My computer is less than cooperative. French do universities, and the British do food. Now, that wouldn't be a great world, would it? So the idea is we as Americans, we have some wonderful features of our food system, but can we learn something from looking around the world at other places? And I'm going to talk particularly about what we might be able to learn from another culture, somewhat like ours, France, which is roughly as affluent as we are and has many of the same values. Now, in life expectancy, as you can see on this slide, the French are tied for 10th in the world with an average life expectancy of 81. We are 19.5. We're only 2 years less at 79. That's not a big difference. And, you know, you could argue that it's partly due to the fact that we have a larger underclass, more solid, a higher percent of poorer people than the French. But anyway, the point is the French are doing pretty well. That's the only point I want to raise here. Though I will point out, just since we're at this, that if you look at the top country is Japan, which does eat what we would call a pretty healthy diet by what the USDA says. But Australia and Spain and Switzerland, which are three of the six next countries, don't. That is, they eat a diet somewhat like us, quite high in animal fat and dairy, and they're up there. In fact, the next one is Canada Day also. Okay. Now, the interesting thing about the French, you've heard of the French paradox. It's a paradox. It's not a paradox, but it's called a paradox because the French seem to be healthier than we are, and yet they eat a higher fat diet. Let me do a higher saturated fat diet than we are. This is some data that represents that. It's not necessarily representative, but it's one of the biggest studies, the Monica study. And this is for mortality per 100,000 in Toulouse, France. That's in the south of France. In Lille, France, that's the north of France, a somewhat different diet, and in Stanford, USA. So you can see that, in general, the French have about a third less heart disease than we do. Of course, they die, and they only die 2 years later than us, so they have all sorts of other things that they die of. But heart disease has been a focus of dietary advice, so this is of some interest. Obesity is half the level in France as it is in the United States. And again, the reason this is interesting is that the French eat what we would call a pretty high caloric density diet. Okay, so I'm going to tell you about some work we've done on understanding how the French differ from the Americans. And this has been done with Claude Fischler, who is a French sociologist of food, and many, many students. I would list them, but you wouldn't get through the list. Almost entirely undergraduates. So let me start with a simple one. I want you to think of the three words that first come to your mind when you think of chocolate. Okay. Here are the results that we got. We happen to have India in this one, too. Let's look at the females. No one in India thought none of those words were a fat word like chocolate, like calories, fat, fattening, something like that. 4% of the French women in those three words had any word like that, and 27% of the American adults had that, of the women. So that is to say, when they think about this incredibly delicious food, one of the major, it's a major achievement of civilization to have come up with chocolate, they're thinking of its effect on their body rather than delicious, yummy, or a brand, perhaps a favorite brand. Okay. We ask people, how do you think about food? This is like the chocolate. What do you think of when you think of heavy cream? We give them a choice. Do you think of whipped or unhealthy? Only 28% of the French women think of unhealthy. 68% of the American women do. These are college students, but some of the data is from college students, some is from adults. It's about the same. Okay, so that is to say, Americans, and there's a lot of questions like this, Americans tend to think of food as something that has an effect on their body, good or bad, depending on what they believe. And the French tend to think of food as what's in their mouth, the experience of eating it. Now, we ask people, do you eat a healthy diet? 76% of the French women say yes, only 28% of the American women. The French women are not eating low-fat food. They're not eating low-salt food. They're eating their traditional food, which has a fair amount of animal products. And they are saying they're eating healthy. They're eating the way the French have always eaten. And we are making all of these attempts to improve the health of our diet and are not even getting the benefit of thinking it's beneficial. So there's something wrong there. This is an interesting question. This is from adults. as opposed to students, but food and medicine are fundamentally different. Do you agree with that? 74% of the French strongly agree with that, and only 16% of Americans. So that is to say, French think of food as what you eat. It's not what it does to your body. And the Americans think of food, of course, as having this effect on heart disease, on stomach pain, or whatever. And it's interesting that in France, you don't sell food in drugstores, and you don't sell drugs in food stores. They're totally separate places. And there are rules about making sure that that's true. Another example, we say, what is the relation of food to your body? And we give people four choices, a tree, taking nutrients up from the soil, a car, you know, using fuel, or a factory manufacturing something, or a temple, a place of special significance. And the majority of the French think of the tree metaphor, and the highest of a score for the Americans is a car or a factory. So we have a more mechanical view of eating, you're processing food, and theirs is basically more of a natural view, like all animals, including a tree. Okay. Now, there was a very interesting book written in the 1960s by a journalist named Lynn Payer called Medicine and Culture, in which she argued that she looked at four countries, U.S., U.K., France, and Germany, and she argued that medical practice, what physicians believe and practice, is heavily influenced by the culture they are in, as well as medical, quote, knowledge. And we did a study some years ago on a sample of French, German, Italian, American, and British subjects, doctors and normal citizens. And we asked them a whole bunch of questions about diet. You know, is a moderate amount of meat healthy? Should people control their salt intake? All sorts of things like that. And what we discovered was that the doctors were more similar to the lay people in their country than they were to the doctors in the next country. So that French doctors were more in agreement with lay French people than they were with German doctors about what was healthy and what was not. That was true across every country. In each country, the doctor was more similar to the lay people than to the doctors in the other countries. So this is a powerful influence. So what we hear about nutrition is partly coming from the USDA in America, is partly an American cultural product. Okay. So we decided to look at the environment of the French, not just what their beliefs are, which I showed you are different about food, but also the environment, because the environment is extremely important. You only eat what's in front of you. That's a pretty obvious rule, right? You can't eat if it's not there. So we went into McDonald's, and we weighed the same seven foods that we ordered in Paris and in Philadelphia, and we discovered that that same seven food weighed 189 grams in Paris and 256 grams in Philadelphia. Now, that's interesting. Could you go into McDonald's and you have a meal, and you have, you know, your hamburger and your fries and your shake and all that, and you get a different amount of calories. So it turns out that when French serve food, we have a lot of data on this, they serve people less food in restaurants. We went to all sorts of restaurants. There are three listed on your side, but we went to a whole bunch. And their ice cream scoop is much smaller than ours, by the way. So that's sort of one of the basic differences between these cultures is how much food they put in front of you. Here's another example. This is from supermarkets, a Philadelphia one and a Paris one. And we looked at the modal side. This is about 2000. Things have changed a little in the last 15 years. So the modal size of yogurt, which is the size that I have the most examples of, okay, was 125 grams in Carrefour, 227 grams in the United States. The calorie difference is smaller because the French yogurt is mostly full fat, and the American yogurt is mostly reduced fat. So the difference would be smaller in calories. But even their fruit was smaller. You know, their apples, their apricots, and their Coca-Cola standard can was 500 ml in the United States and 330 in France. And since it turns out that people eat usually one of something. As you know, you don't usually eat two sandwiches or drink two Cokes. So if it's a little smaller, you just drink it and move on, and the French move on with less calories. That's a picture of the standard, at that time, the standard French and the standard American yogurt, both, by the way, made by a French company. The American yogurts are starting to get a little smaller. The American food industry, or the importers to America, are starting to recognize the importance of portion size. And if they can make as much money on a smaller portion, why shouldn't they do it? And they are doing it. So this is changing in the right direction. We have also looked, we thought maybe this had to do with just, you know, the metric system or something. So we went to the supermarkets and looked at everything, broom sizes, everything. Here are the three things that we looked at. See, the American toothpaste size was larger, the most common, but the cat food was larger in France. And most critically, the toilet paper square is larger in France than in the United States, even though they eat less food. So that's sort of interesting. Okay. Now we move to, as soon as I can get it to move. Okay, and here is.
Can I ask you a question?
Absolutely.
We had a question from a listener. Their question is, they were curious, there's this phenomenon of being malnourished, but at the same time being overweight and obese. And they give an example of, you know, diets of full or fat and sugar, like those in urban Latin America and poor areas in the U.S., and other locations experience this twin phenomenon. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, the question is, thanks for the question. It's really about the extent to which the percent of the foods we eat are basically, you know, what sometimes called empty calories, right? Like Coke, pure calories. We don't have direct data on that, but just from observation, I can tell you that the French eat much less of that. First of all, they don't snack much. And a lot of these foods are eaten as, you know, in between meal snacks. Also, their desserts are often fruit, as opposed to our desserts, which are usually some much more caloric and sometimes empty calorie combination. So I think it's certainly true that they're, I'm focusing on the weight now, but of course the French health is not just having to do with their being thinner. It has to do with their combination of foods seems more nutritive, even though it is higher. It is not higher in meat, by the way, but they do eat a fair amount of meat, and they eat quite a bit of dairy, usually in the form of cheese, which is, of course, highly caloric, but also quite nutritive. Okay, so this slide is just to indicate that we are starting, those are American Cokes, that's the standard one on your left, and as you all know, you can get the one on the right now, and you pay more per ounce, which is how come the food industry probably can make it a wash as to whether, which one they sell, but, you know, if you really want to get your money, you buy a 2-liter bottle of Coke, right, and then you pay much less per ounce, but we are at least trying. At least there's some evidence that there's some attempt to scale down. And the reason this can work is insofar as the food companies don't have to pay a price for it, they're perfectly happy to present a fewer calories to people. We'll see how that plays out. Okay. Now, the other side, of course, is energy expenditure, which I won't talk much about. And we don't have any really good data on this. It's very hard to get data on energy expenditure from people. It's much easier to get data on what they eat. Because, for example, in France, bicycling is a very common activity, and most of the devices which measure activity require, not all of them, but require the impact of the foot on the ground, and you don't get that in a bicycle. But just two examples. I lived in Dijon, France for a while, and this was not an atypical place I lived in. So I was on the fourth floor of an apartment, which had no elevator. So, and then when you wanted to drive somewhere, you'd go out and your car was in a little, like its own little garageette. So you have to go in there, open the door, get in your car if you were alone, start the car, get out of the car, close the door, get to the front gate at the bottom of the sign. Then, can you see my pointer here? I'm pointing. Well, if not, it doesn't matter. Okay, see the front of the gate at the bottom? You have to open the gate. At that time, it was not automated. This is about 10 years ago. You'd have to park, go on the street, park, and close the gate. And you know what? That's a lot of work to just go 8 blocks to the store and also the gas is very high. So, you know, we didn't use the car. We went to the market, which is 6 or 8 blocks away. Virtually every day we walked because the whole setup was easier. Here's another more fanciful example. The French love dogs, and their dogs poop on the street, and they don't pick them up because they don't have the strong car. Here's a street in a village in France, and I've highlighted 3 dog poops for you with Red Arrow. So what happens is that if you're walking in the United States down the street, you just go straight. But in France, you're dodging the dog doos all the time, and so you actually spend more energy because you have to walk more steps to go down the same street. Now, that's a little silly, but it's not entirely silly, because the idea is that very small things that you do every day over and over, like eating a little less calories or walking a little more, can add up over a year to a significant difference in weight. So little things like where you park at the supermarket. Suppose, for example, supermarkets blocked out the sides, the parking spots within 50 yards when it was nice out. So you'd have to do a little more walking. I mean, there are little things like that. There's a lot more use of public transportation and less of cars in all of Europe, partly because of the expense of driving. And so they just walk more because their environment makes it easy to walk. Now, this is I wanted to get a picture of a French dinner, so I put French dinner into Google, and this was French family dinner. This came up. I don't think it's a French dinner, but it makes the point I want to make. I don't know who these people are. But what you'll notice in this family is that everybody has the same thing on their plate. And that's the characteristic of the French. The French dinner is very ritualized. Everybody sits there for the whole length of the meal. There's one set of food served, and everybody eats them. Nobody gets macaroni and cheese if they don't like what's being served. It's just sort of taken for granted that we all eat the same thing. And since their basic food includes salad and vegetables and meat, you know, they get a pretty rounded meal. So the point of this is that the French have every dinner is a special occasion. It's not like our dinner, especially in 2 wage earner families where, you know, everyone may not even eat together, and sometimes the kids are eating different things, sometimes at different times, sometimes the family's watching television during dinner. This is not typical of France. They have preserved their traditional way of eating much better than we have, because we ate more like this 100 years ago. Okay, so here are some basic French differences. They value moderation. We value abundance. So our great dinner is the Thanksgiving dinner, right? And it's a successful dinner. Say grandma cooked the dinner. It's a successful dinner if somebody says, oh, it was so good, I ate so much I can't stand up. And that's considered, oh, grandma's been successful. The French think that's funny. They think of eating small amounts of very good food. So they focus on quality. They have much more collective values. That is to say, there's a French set of what it is to eat. Now, they're less receptive than we are to ethnic foods, which is potentially a problem for them. I mean, I think ethnic foods are wonderful, both in terms of health and taste. But they have a sense of what a meal is, you know, including an appetizer, a main course, and dessert. And when you go to a French restaurant, as some of you may know, you don't get this menu that is like everything known on earth. You get maybe 3 appetizer choices, 3 main courses, a couple of desserts. And the main courses, say it's going to be a steak, they tell you what the vegetables are. They don't say you can have French fries or potato salad or baked potatoes or mashed potatoes. The chef picks the combination for you. So they have much more of a sense of what's a right meal. And, of course, their eating occasions are much more. And the other general thing, which I started with, is they think of food more as a pleasureful thing than a worry. So Americans, particularly American women, are very ambivalent about food. They usually love it, but they feel bad about eating much, even if much isn't very much. And so they are both unhappy about their food worlds and actually not doing as well as the French, who are just enjoying the food. Okay, so just a general picture now to lead into Naomi. There's a concept called pre-adaptation, which is very important in both biological and cultural evolution. Ernst Mayr is the great evolutionary biologist most associated with this. And the idea is that something that evolves for one purpose is used for another. this happens over and over in evolution. The best example for you is the mouth, which was definitely evolved to eat, right? The teeth and the tongue. But when we develop language in our evolutionary history, the mouth becomes taken over by the speech system, and it is also used as a form of expression. So we have something that evolved as a food thing being used for something else. And that's happened a lot with food, which is the cause of the spread of meaning of food. So we can say food is initially about nutrition and pleasure, but we use it as a social marker. We celebrate occasions with it. If you think highly of someone on a date, you take them to a nicer restaurant. All sorts of stuff. Going to grandma's house is eating this wonderful food that you've always had since you were a child. It becomes an art form. Anyone who spends more than a few dollars for dinner in our country is not just buying nutrition, they're buying an experience. And if you spend $50, you certainly are buying experience. Or if you're not, you shouldn't go to that restaurant anymore. Food is also used as a metaphor. That's a form of pre-adaptation. So I say, Harry is a sweet person. Right? Or something like, oh, I can't swallow your argument. That's using food words for other purposes. And perhaps most interesting, especially now in the modern world, food becomes a moral entity. First of all, for some people, overweight or obesity is a moral failing. But in forgetting that, people realize now that when they eat, they're having an effect on the world. They're making a choice, and you'll hear more about that from Naomi. So let me just close with an example of this from meat. Meat, of course, is about taste and nutrition. It's a form of nutrition. Certainly, it satisfies many of our short-term needs, and it tastes good to most people. But now we have issues about long-term health in meat. So meat, this was not part of our, you know, a thousand years ago, nobody worried about this. But now we worry about the effects of a high meat diet. It's somehow associated with masculinity. That is to say, meat eating is more male than female. We have data that suggests that people think that. By the way, they only think that from mammal muscle. They don't think that eating fish is more male, but they think that eating beef is more male. It's a sign of status. In many countries in the world, the developing world, the wealthier you are, the more meat in your diet. So that's a statement, in some sense, of what you can afford. Meat is the most shared food because the way meat comes, it's in a hunk, like a chicken or, well, of course, a cow, or you can break that up to pieces. But people usually have to share it. They have to cut it and serve it out. So way back in our tradition when we had a large animal to eat, it was inevitable that sharing occurred. And, of course, meat is used as a metaphor a lot. So I say, let's get to the meat of the topic. So it's used a lot as a word, or some meaning heart or something. And finally, in the modern world, meat has implications because environmentally, it's an inefficient way of preserving our ecology. As you know, you need, depends on what you read, but certainly 5 to 10, depending on the kind of meat, say for the moment, 5 times the amount of calories to take in to get a calorie of meat. So that is to say, it's just not an efficient way to generate food for us in terms of the environment and all the effects on the environment. And there's other effects of meat too. And finally, can you see the last point? It's not on my slide. It should be, but it's compassion. We are also concerned about the effect of eating on killing of animals or maltreatment of animals, and we have a rising vegetarianism in the world, partly motivated by the fact that people do not feel we can ethically kill animals. So let me now just move to what Naomi's going to say. We're trying to scale up our research, and Naomi is involved in this. So we are collaborating with people at the University of Konstanz, and we're going to be studying 10 countries and what food means to them, what they know about food, what motives they have for eating it, and the meaning of food, which you will hear about momentarily. And Naomi Arbit is one of the 6 people doing this, and here is a map of the 10 countries we are using. They're spread around the world. That's Ghana in Africa, Turkey, India, Japan, and China, Brazil, Mexico, United States. So we're going to try to make a really thorough, and we're trying to get not just people who are online, but people in villages to report in an interview how food functions in their life, what they eat, what they know about health and food, and what about the meaning of food. And so to expand on the meaning of food, I'm going to turn this over to Naomi Arbit.
Thank you, Paul. We're going to give Naomi a second here to pull the slides up on her computer. Naomi, you should have a command that says show my screen. Naomi, are you able to see the command?
What happened to Naomi?
Oh, it looks like she might be having to dial back in. Hold on a second, everybody.
Meanwhile, if you have any questions for me.
Hi, I'm back. I'm sorry about that.
Okay, good.
My computer. Rachel?
Yeah, do you have the show my screen request?
No.
Hold on a second. I think it thinks you're on twice, so hold on a second. Let me give it another try here. Oh, there we go. Okay, so we're seeing all of the computer screen. If you can get us back to the single slide, then we will be in good shape.
And then Dr. Paul Rosen, you can actually hit the mute button.
The mute button on my telephone, you mean?
The mic button you'll see at the top.
Okay.
I don't know if I have it, but I'll put the phone down if I don't have it.
Thanks.
Okay, great. Rachel, can you see the slides?
Yes, I can see your slide. You're in good shape.
Excellent. Thanks. Sorry about that. So I'm going to do a slightly abbreviated version of this presentation for the sake of time to give people some time to ask questions, but we made the slides available so everyone should have a larger selection of these slides to go through in greater detail. So thank you for that great introduction, Paul. I started working with Paul a few years ago with the goal of creating a questionnaire that actually assesses the meaning of food in life. So by way of some background, there's a confluence of factors that have made the time right for this investigation. On the one hand, we have extensive qualitative and ethnographic evidence for the multiple meanings that food holds for people. And historically, we know that our relationship with food was laden with meanings that figured importantly in our moral, symbolic, and ecological worlds. And even in the current global food system, as Paul just illustrated, there are stable cross-country differences in how people relate to food, often tied to their worldview and value system. In the health behavior and nutrition literature, these meanings have not been formally operationalized for empirical investigation. Typically, they use rational cost-benefit analyses and expectancy value theories that have moderate explanatory power and don't yet measure constructs such as moral norms or meanings. We also know, on the other hand, that the food environment is currently undergoing change. Similarly to what happened with tobacco smoking, we're seeing broad-scale changes in awareness and moralizing of food issues. So here are some slides, like some examples from Whole Foods, so you can see things such as values matter, or eat like an idealist. So people are really even starting to market their food products by targeting these value systems and the sort of shifting meanings that food is holding for people. So we see that food's coming to take on meanings to a degree unseen in prior generations. People are focused on clean, pure foods, natural foods, ethical and artisanal foods. There's almost a new omnivore's dilemma that has resulted from expanding spheres of moral concern in the developed world, where people are increasingly concerned about environmental, animal welfare, and humanitarian concerns. And yet, how do we measure these shifting meanings and what their effect might be on food intake? So this is just a little illustration of the confluence of factors that have made the time ripe for this project. So our research aims with the Meaning of Food and Life questionnaire was to operationalize what the meaning of food and life means so that we could start to empirically study it. We endeavor to develop and validate a comprehensive measure to assess the different domains of meaning that food holds for people and also to examine it as a new determinant of health behavior. So by doing that, we explored its association with dietary intake patterns, local and organic purchasing decisions, and willingness to pay to ensure socially responsible outcomes. And towards the end of this presentation, we'll actually go over some of the results that we found. So in order to operationalize meaning, we actually did an in-depth review of the psychology of meaning. And in the psychology of meaning, meaning is typically construed as a stable, higher order, and abstract construct that involves making connections between and integrating events and experiences into a larger and coherent sense of order. It involves an understanding of oneself and one's world, as well as one's role in the world. So people have said that, like, in order to classify something as meaning, you might say, if an action is meaningful, it is included into the meaning web and thus finds a place in the whole person's life world rather than in the demands of the situation. So if we were going to extend this sort of criterion for classifying something as meaningful to the domain of food, we might ask, to what degree are people making food decisions from the perspective of their life world? So therefore, we were able to come up with a criterion and sort of definition for the meaning of food in life, saying that the meaning of food in life represents the degree to which people see their food and eating experiences as having significance beyond the immediate demands of the situation and as connected to their larger life world. It involves a cognitive connection being made between people's immediate, between people's food intake and non-immediate aspects of the eating situation. And this can be directly contrasted with very, like, immediate and hedonic orientations to food choice, which are focused on things such as convenience, price, taste, and timing. So based on this definition, the research team, that was the theoretical background for this investigation. So using that theoretical background as sort of the scaffolding, we then did two qualitative studies in which we asked over 300 participants from the United States how they would define the meaning of food in their life. So using a theoretical background and a detailed content analysis of their qualitative responses, we generated a set of question items to start testing empirically and to see how these items hung together and what factors we might be able to discern from the data. So based on the analysis of the qualitative studies, the qualitative responses, and then four iterative rounds of data collection, we came up with a set of 22 final items comprising the meaning and food and life questionnaire. This is just a schematic of our data collection process. We recruited subjects via Mechanical Turk in the USA. Our first exploratory study, we collected data from 150 subjects, and in the three subsequent studies, we collected data from over 200 subjects each. So the results of the repeated empirical analyses showed that we had there was a five-factor structure which cohered consistently across all four studies. So we found that there are primarily five domains of the MFL. Though currently our research team is also exploring a sixth possible domain of identity, but that's really a subject for further research. And these five domains are going to be the following. I'm going to go through them one by one and give some sample items from each.
Hey, Naomi, can I ask you a question? What is Mechanical Turk?
Oh, sure. Mechanical Turk is actually connected to Amazon.com, and it's an online platform where you can recruit study participants and pay them on an hourly basis for their participation in your studies. It's very commonly used in psychology and a number of other social sciences as a means of collecting data.
Oh, thank you for clarifying.
No problem. So our first factor is the moral factor, and some sample items from the moral factor include: when I eat food, I think about where it came from. I eat in a way that expresses care for the world, and my food choices reflect my connection to nature. Our second factor is a social factor, and some of our sample items include: food is closely tied to my relationships with others. When I eat, I feel connected to the people I'm eating with, and food is a way for me to connect with my cultural traditions. We also have an aesthetic factor, so preparing a good meal is like making a work of art. Eating a good meal is an aesthetic experience, like going to a good concert or reading a good novel. and I can appreciate the beauty of a dish even if I do not like it. We also have a sacred factor. What I eat is a reflection of my spiritual beliefs. From a spiritual perspective, some foods are better than others, and my food choices are a way for me to connect with the sacred. Lastly, we have the health factor, with such questions as I get satisfaction from knowing that the food I eat is good for my health, and I feel that nourishing my body is a meaningful activity, as well as I eat in a way that expresses care for my body. So those were the five domains that we found so far in our data. And we also did test-retest reliability of this questionnaire. We found that it was high for every single one of these domains. It was above 0.8. And we also showed, in order to demonstrate validity, which just means that we're measuring what we're trying to measure, and we found that each of these domains displayed consistently significant associations with patterns of dietary intake, purchasing habits, and willingness to pay. So we measured dietary intake using validated questions that were used in the NHANES Dietary Screener Questionnaire. Participants were asked how frequently they consumed the following foods in the past 30 days, and we asked them about fruit, vegetable, red meat, processed snack, and junk food consumption. Participants were able to respond using a 10-point scale ranging from never to 4-plus times per day. And they were also asked about self-reported behavior. So we asked them questions such as, I limit my intake of fast food, and I substitute meat with meat substitutes when possible. So we found that there were significant correlations between the MFL factors and intake of soda, processed snacks, junk food, and fast food. So for instance, as you can see, the moral and health domains were significantly and negatively associated with the dietary intake of soda and dietary intake of processed snacks and junk food. And they were also positively and significantly associated with limiting one's intake of fast food, as were the social and aesthetic domains. We also find that actually all five domains of the MFL questionnaire were significantly and positively associated with increased dietary intake of vegetables, and four domains, not including aesthetic, were also associated with greater intake of fruits. We found that the moral, sacred, and health domains were negatively associated with red meat intake, and that the moral and sacred domains were positively associated with substituting meat with meat substitutes. Additionally, all five domains of the MFL were significantly positively associated with a willingness to pay increased food prices in order to protect the environment and ensure a standard of animal welfare. We also found all five domains of the MFL were significantly and positively associated with buying organic and local foods. So overall, we found that the MFL is a valid and new construct for assessing the meaning of food in people's lives. The different domains, as we've mentioned, are health, moral, sacred, aesthetic, and social. And these domains display different associations with dietary intake patterns, organic and local food purchasing behavior, and a willingness to pay higher prices for socially responsible outcomes. Our next step, as I already mentioned, is exploring identity as a possible sixth factor, and the 10-country study that Paul just mentioned, where we were going to use this questionnaire and actually test it in 10 different countries. So based on prior research that Paul's done, he's found that there are actually like very meaningful differences between the way that people in India and people in the United States approach their food intake. So for instance, and this is something that we would expect to translate directly into the results that we would find in the 10-country study, in India, both males and females find that eating is a social occasion to a degree, I mean, almost the relationship is inverse that of the United States. So in India, they're much more likely to feel that sharing food enhances the eating experiences, and it is important for me to sit down and enjoy a meal with family and friends. So if we were going to extend that hypothesis to what we would find in the 10-country study, we might say that in India, we would expect to find people would score much more highly on the social factor of the MFL than they would in the United States. This is another piece of data that comes from Paul's prior data set, and it shows that in India also, it's the same inverse relationship with the United States. People feel that eating is a religious experience, and their diet must adhere to strict moral and religious principles. So using something like this, we might also hypothesize that the India data would show much higher scores on the sacred and the moral domain of the MFL when compared to the United States. In terms of concern about overweight, dieting, and calorie control, we actually no longer see this inverse relationship, and therefore you might expect actually that we would find similar scores on the health domain of the MFL. So that's all. Thank you for your attention, and let us know if you have any questions.
Great. Thank you both Naomi Arbit and also Dr. Paul Rosen. If anybody has any questions, we do have time for them. Please put them in their question box and we'll hopefully get to them all. One of the questions goes back to one of the earlier slides Dr. Paul Rosen had up, looking at malnutrition and the bigger, and seeing that in his statement that malnutrition is a bigger problem than obesity. One of the listeners believe that obesity and malnutrition almost go hand in hand in some areas of the world, and they were wondering if you could address the question of malnutrition in the world and obesity kind of hand in hand.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. That's a good question, of course. Well, first of all, let me just say that the way things are going, the obesity and malnutrition curves will cross in not too long, which is they'll be more obese than malnourished people. But so in terms of concern, there's going to be appropriately more concern about obesity as we deal with the malnutrition problem. But I think the question is about the fact that obesity, though it involves an excess of energy, can also be a nutrition problem, because the energy can almost all come in forms that are not very nutritive, like basically sugar and fats without many vitamins and minerals. So that we do have a problem that in the developing world, the favorite foods are, of course, things like Coca-Cola and fast food. So those, they have great appeal, as in the United States, and they're relatively cheap. So we do have a problem that's going to become more and more serious as we get rid of the calorie malnutrition of getting highly nutritive diets to people. And that's more complicated because it means getting people to override their immediate desire for sweet and fat, and thinking, having a little longer term view that's similar to what is discussed in the health factor in what Naomi just told you.
Okay, great, thank you. Another question. Can you explain what the differences in food practices are in low food secure households in France versus the U.S.?
The differences in low food security households in France and the U.S., is that the question?
Yeah, yes.
Okay, mm-hmm. Well, I can't answer that question directly because I don't know. But I would say that in general, the French notion of eating and the meal is goes all the way through the socioeconomic classes. Now, there are, of course, immigrants in France, as in the United States, who bring their own cuisines in, so that's another story. But for traditional French people who are relatively poor, my guess is they still eat a rather traditional diet, probably lower in meat and some other things that are more expensive. But we don't know this.
Okay, thanks. I guess to follow up to that question, they were wondering if you had any demographic information on the participants for the validation study. I guess this is a question for you, Naomi. And they were just curious about the socioeconomic status and ethnic minority representation of the validation study.
Sure. We found that it was actually fairly well representative. We asked a question about socioeconomic status, and we asked questions about gender, age, and education. And we also tested our results controlling for those factors, and we didn't find a difference.
Okay.
But I should say that none of the studies done up to now, we hope to change that with our new study, deal with people who are not online. And in the United States, the great majority is online. In India, that's not true. So the good half of India that's pretty rural and not online is not part of the any data that has come out of India so far that I know.
Great. And another question, they were wondering if others would be able to use the questionnaire in their research studies, or if it's freely available.
Yes, if you send an email to Paul or myself, we're happy to share the questionnaire.
Great. Another question we had. They were curious as to whether the perception of getting a good deal plays a role in the French eating habits, as it seems to in American eating habits. And they were kind of indicating in particular about the super size that we have here in America, because it's a good deal as an example. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Super sizes, everyone loves, I think everyone wants a good deal. And 2-liter bottles of soda are a good deal. First of all, the French don't drink that much soda. But it is generally true that you get a better deal with big sizes. And Brian Wansink has shown that if you pour yourself a drink or take spaghetti out of a box or whatever, from a large box, you take out more. That is to say, your portion size goes up as a function of the size of the entity that you're taking it from. So supersizing actually increases intake, it turns out. So there's less of it in France, but the sad news is that France is becoming more, like the whole world is becoming more like the United States. We have a very appealing system which delivers very strong, good, tasty things for relatively little money. And even McDonald's has been surprisingly successful in France, which the French are ashamed of, but it is true. So we are, some things of ours, like democratic institutions maybe, or universities, are spreading those systems to the world, and that's a good thing. It's not clear that our system of eating is a good thing to spread around the world, but it seems to have a lot of appeal, even in France.
Okay, great. Thanks. And I guess this is a good question for you, Naomi. They were curious as to whether or not you plan on doing cognitive interviewing on the questions that are going to be, I guess, the 10-country study, making sure that, you know, the questions are being answered in the same way and they're not being interpreted differently. I don't know if you have any plans for that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We've actually already started pilot testing in those countries, and we have collaborators in each of the countries where we're, you know, they're going over each of the question items, and we're working with each of them to make sure that they translate appropriately.
Okay, great. Well, I'm very excited to hear what the results of that study will be. We do also have another question. Their question is, what is the influence of socioeconomic status, particularly income and education, in regards to the questionnaire? From their point of view, it seems that one would have to achieve a certain level of affluence to be able to afford to be moralistic about food.
Yeah, I mean, we commonly come across this question, and even we were wondering whether that would be the case, but we've actually controlled for income and education and found no difference. And even in a lot of our qualitative samples, we think that might be an assumption, but an erroneous assumption, because the data just haven't borne that out. So it could be an influence of the larger culture, right? So even if people are living in the U.S. and they have low socioeconomic status or low education, they might still see like these Whole Foods ads, and somehow the sort of like broader cultural changes might still have be exerting their influence.
Okay.
So we do have more obesity in the United States. The inverse of the developing world, where being heavier implies being wealthier, having more food. In the United States, the lower classes are heavier than the upper classes. So I suspect there is some effect, and across culture there will be. If you are worrying about how you're going to get enough food for tomorrow, it's probably not much space in your mind for worrying about the state of the forests around the world.
Right. It's almost getting to this idea of cognitive load, in a sense. Yeah, how much we can handle. Well, unfortunately, we're running out of time, but we really do appreciate both of you speaking today on this topic, and I'm sure if anyone listening has any questions, they can reach out to both of you. And I'll let Rachel kind of close out today's presentation with a couple of final last things.
Excellent. Thank you. Very interesting presentation. Just a reminder, I'm going to try to get the follow-up email out this afternoon with the link to the recording. The slides, again, as a handout, as well as the CEU certificate. When I close out the webinar, there'll be a short survey. We'd appreciate your feedback on this webinar, as well as ideas for upcoming Journal Club sessions. We will see you back for Journal Club next Monday, looking at adolescent cooking abilities, abilities and behaviors, then we're going to take a break. We have finalized the schedule, so there should be 10 journal clubs in total, and if you'd requested to be registered for all of them, you should have all of your registrations now. If for some reason you think you're missing something, just let me know. And as always, look forward to seeing you again on Monday. We've got a couple other webinars, including one on complexity modeling up on the SNEB website, and I encourage you to check those out as well. Thank you.